Part 1. To Begin the World Anew. Chapter 1. Taking Out the Trash. Waste People in the New World. Colonies ought to be emunctories, or sinks of state, to drain away the filth. John White, The Planter's Plea, 1630. In the minds of literate English men and women, as colonization began in the 1500s, North America was an uncertain world inhabited by monstrous creatures, a blank territory skirted by mountains of gold. Because it was a strange land that few would ever see firsthand, spectacular tales had more appeal than practical observation. England's two chief promoters of American exploration would never set foot on the continent. Richard Hakluyt the Elder, 1530 to 1591, was a lawyer at Middle Temple, a vibrant center of intellectual life and court politics in the London metropolis. His much younger cousin with the identical name, 1552 to 1616, trained at Christ Church, Oxford, and never hazarded a voyage beyond the shores of France. The elder Hakluyt was a bookish attorney who happened to be well connected to those who dreamt of profit from overseas ventures. His circle included merchants, royal officials, and such men on the make as Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, and Martin Frobisher, all of whom sought fame and glory from exploration. These men of action were endowed with larger-than-life egos. They were a new breed of adventurer, known for heroism, but also for ill-tempered public behavior. Richard Hakluyt the Younger was an Oxford fellow and clergyman who devoted his life to compiling the travel narratives of explorers. In 1589, he published his most ambitious work, Principal Navigations, an exhaustive catalogue of all the accounts he could track down of English travelers to the East, the North, and, of course, America. In the age of Shakespeare, everyone who was anyone read Hakluyt. The unstoppable John Smith quoted liberally from his writings, proving himself more than a brute soldier of fortune. Even before publishing Principal Navigations, the younger Hakluyt had sought royal favor. He prepared a treatise for Queen Elizabeth I and her top advisors, laying out his working theory of British colonization. Discourse of Western Planting, 1584, was pure propaganda, designed to persuade the Queen of the benefits of American settlements. Sir Walter Raleigh had commissioned the work, hoping for the state financing he never received, when he launched an expedition that led to the short-lived Roanoke colony off the Carolina coast. In Hakluyt's English colonial vision, distant America was a wilderness of an almost inconceivable dimension. For the French intellectual Michel de Montaigne in 1580, it was the habitat of a simple and uncorrupted people whom he whimsically called cannibals, slyly challenging the popular image of brutes gorging on human flesh. Like Hakluyt, he had never seen native peoples, of course. Hakluyt, at least, was more practical and more Anglican than Montaigne in his outlook on the aboriginals. He believed them neither dangerous nor innocent, but empty vessels waiting to be filled with Christian, and no less commercial, truths. He imagined the Indians as useful allies in fulfilling English aspirations, possible trading partners, and subordinate, to be sure, but above all, a natural resource to be exploited for the greater good. Attaching empty as a metaphor to a mysterious land served the legal purposes of the English state. Without recognized owners, the territory was available and waiting to be taken. Even for the bookish cleric Hakluyt, the trope of conquest he used presented America as a lovely woman waiting to be wooed and wed by the English. They would become her rightful owners and deserving custodians. It was all a fiction, of course, because the land was not really inane ad vacuum, void and vacant, As the English conceived it, however, any land had to be taken out of its natural state and put to commercial use. Only then would it be truly owned. Obviously, the Indian occupants were deemed unable to possess a true title. Combing ancient laws for convincing analogies, English colonizers classified the natives as savages and sometimes as barbarians. The Indians did not build what the English would acknowledge as permanent homes and towns. They did not enclose the workable ground inside hedges and fences. Under their tenancy, the land appeared unbounded and untamed, what John Smith, in his accounts of Virginia and later New England, described as very rank and weedy. The Indians lived off the earth as passive nomads. Profit-seeking planters and industrious husbandmen, on the other hand, were needed to cultivate the ground for its riches, and in doing so, impose a firm hand. This powerful conception of land use would play a key role in future categorizations of race and class on the experimental continent. Before they even established new and busy societies, colonizers denoted some people as entrepreneurial stewards of the exploitable land. They declared others, the vast majority, as mere occupiers, a people with no measurable investment in productivity or in commerce. Whether barren or empty, uncultivated or rank, the land acquired a quintessentially English meaning. The English were obsessed with waste, which was why America was first and foremost a wasteland in their eyes. Wasteland meant undeveloped land, land that was outside the circulation of commercial exchange and apart from the understood rules of agricultural production. To lie in waste, in biblical language, meant to exist desolate and unattended. In agrarian terms, it was to be left fallow and unimproved. Wasteland was idle land. Arable tracts of desirable property could only be associated with furrowed fields, rows of crops and fruit trees, golden waves of grain, and pasture for cattle and sheep. John Smith embraced the same ideological premise with a precise, if crude, illusion. The Englishman's right to the land was ensured by his commitment to carpeting the soil with manure. An English elixir of animal waste would magically transform the Virginia wilderness, making untilled wasteland into valuable English territory. Waste was there to be treated and then exploited. Waste was wealth as yet unrealized. In his Discourse of Western Planting, Hakluyt confidently described the entire continent as that waste firm of America. Not terra firma, but waste firm. He saw natural resources as raw materials that could be converted into valuable commodities. Like other Englishmen of his day, he equated wastelands with commons, forests, and fens, those lands that 16th-century agrarian improvers eyed for prospective profits. Wasteland served the interest of private owners in the commercial marketplace, when the commons was enclosed and sheep and cattle grazed there. Forests could be cut down for timber and cleared for settlements. Fens or marshes could be drained and reconstituted as rich, arable farmland. It was not just land that could be waste. People could be waste, too. And this brings us to our most important point of embarkation. Hakluyt's America required what he classified as waste people, the cores of laborers needed to cut down the trees, beat the hemp for making rope, gather honey, salt and dry fish, dress raw animal hides, dig the earth for minerals, raise olives and silk, and sort and pack bird feathers. He pictured paupers, vagabonds, convicts, debtors, and lusty young men without employment doing all such work. The fry, young children, of wandering beggars that grow up idly and hurtfully and burdenous to the realm might be unladen and better bred up. Merchants would be sent to trade with the Indians, selling trinkets, venting cloth goods, and gathering more information about the interior of the continent. Artisans were needed, millwrights to process the timber, carpenters, brickmakers, and plasterers to build the settlement, cooks, launderers, bakers, tailors, and cobblers to service the infant colony. Where would these workers come from? The artisans, he felt, could be spared without weakening the English economy, but the bulk of the labor force was to come from the swelling numbers of poor and homeless. They were, in Hakluyt's disturbing allusion, ready to eat up one another, already cannibalizing the British economy. Idle and unused, they were waiting to be transplanted to the American land to be better, albeit no more humanely, put to use. This view of poverty was widely shared. One persistent project, first promoted in 1580 but never realized, involved raising a fleet of 100-ton fishing vessels comprising 10,000 men, half of whom were to be impoverished vagrants. The galley labor scheme was designed to beat the famously industrious Dutch at the fishing trade. Leading mathematician and geographer John Dee was another who imagined a maritime solution to poverty. In 1577, as the British Navy expanded, he proposed converting the poor into sailors. Others wished for the indigent to be swept from the streets, one way or another, whether gathered up as forced laborers building highways and fortifications, or herded into prisons and workhouses. London's Bridewell Prison was chartered in 1553, the first institution of its kind to propose reformation of vagrants. By the 1570s, more houses of corrections had opened their doors. Their founders offered to train the children of the poor to be brought up in labor and work, so they would not follow in the footsteps of their parents and become idle rogues. In this sense, what Hakluyt foresaw in a colonized America was one giant workhouse. This cannot be emphasized enough. As the waste firm of America was settled, it would become a place where the surplus poor, the waste people of England, could be converted into economic assets. The land and the poor could be harvested together to add to, rather than continue to subtract from, the nation's wealth. Among the first waves of workers were the convicts, who would be employed at heavy labor, felling trees and burning them for pitch, tar, and soap ash. Others would dig in the mines for gold, silver, iron, and copper. The convicts were not paid wages. As debt slaves, they were obliged to repay the English Commonwealth for their crimes by producing commodities for export. In return, they would be kept from a life of crime, avoiding, in Hakluyt's words, being miserably hanged or packed into prisons to pitifully pine away and die. As he saw it, the larger reward would be reaped in the next generation. By importing raw goods from the New World and exporting cloth and other commodities in return, the poor at home would find work so that not one poor creature would feel impelled to steal, to starve, and beg as they do. They would prosper along with the growth of colonial trade. The children of wandering beggars, having been kept from idleness and made able by their own honest and easy labor, would grow up responsibly, without surcharging others. Children who escaped pauperism, no longer burdens on the state, might re-enter the workforce as honest laborers. The poor fry sent overseas would now be better bred up, making the lot of the English people better off and the working poor more industrious. It all sounded perfectly logical and realizable. Seeing the indigent as wastrels, as the dregs of society, was certainly nothing new. The English had waged a war against the poor, especially vagrants and vagabonds, for generations. A series of laws in the 14th century led to a concerted campaign to root out this wretched mother of all vice. By the 16th century, harsh laws and punishments were fixed in place. public stocks were built in towns for runaway servants, along with whipping posts and cages variously placed around London. Hot branding irons and ear boring identified this underclass and set them apart as a criminal contingent. An act of 1547 allowed for vagrants to be branded with a V on their breasts and enslaved. While this unusual piece of legislation appears never to have been put into practice, it was nonetheless a natural outgrowth of the widespread vilification of the poor. By 1584, when Hakluyt drafted his Discourse of Western Planting, the poor were routinely being condemned as thriftless and idle, a diseased and dangerously mobile, unattached people, everywhere running to and fro all over the realm. Compared to swarms of insects, labeled as an overflowing multitude, they were imagined in language as an effluvial current, polluting and taxing England's economic health. Slums enveloped London. As one observer remarked in 1608, the heavy concentrations of poor created a subterranean colony of dirty and disfigured monsters living in caves. They were accused of breeding rapidly and infecting the city with a plague of poverty, thus figuratively designating unemployment a contagious disease. Distant American colonies were presented as a cure. The poor could be purged. In 1622, the famous poet and clergyman John Donne wrote of Virginia in this fashion, describing the new colony as the nation's spleen and liver, draining the ill humors of the body to breed good blood. Others used less delicate imagery. American colonies were emunctories, excreting human waste from the body politic. The elder Richard Hakluyt unabashedly called the transportable poor the offals of our people. The poor were human waste, refuse. The sturdy poor, those without physical injuries, elicited outrage over their idleness. But how could vagabonds, who on average migrated some 20 to 80 miles in a month, be called idle? William Harrison, in his popular Description of England, 1577, offered an explanation. Idleness was wasted energy. The vagabond's constant movement led nowhere. In moving around, they failed, like the Indians, to put down healthy roots and join the settled labor force of servants, tenants, and artisans. Harrison thought of idleness in the same way we might today refer to the idling motor of a car. The motor runs in place. The idle poor were trapped in economic stasis. Waste people, like waste lands, were stagnant. Their energy produced nothing of value. They were like festering weeds ruining an idle garden. Waste land, then, was an eyesore, or what the English called a sinkhole. Waste people were analogized to weeds or sickly cattle grazing on a dunghill. But unlike the docile herd, which were carefully bred and contained in fenced enclosures, the poor could become disruptive and disorderly. They occasionally rioted. The cream of society could not be shielded from the public nuisance of the poor in that they seemed omnipresent at funerals, church services, on highways and byways, in alehouses, and they loitered around Parliament, even at the King's Court. James I was so annoyed with vagrant boys milling around his palace at Newmarket that he wrote the London-based Virginia Company in 1619, asking for its help in removing the offensive population from his site by shipping them overseas. As masterless men, detached and unproductive, the vagrant poor would acquire colonial masters. For Hakluyt and others, a quasi-military model made sense. It had been used in Ireland. In the New World, whether subduing the native population or contending with other European nations with colonial ambitions, fortifications would have to be raised, trenches dug, gunpowder produced, and men trained to use bows. Militarization served other crucial purposes. Ex-soldiers formed one of the largest subgroups of English vagrants. Sailors were the vagrants of the sea and were often drawn into piracy. The style of warfare most common in the 16th century involved attacks on nearly impregnable fortifications and required prolonged sieges and large numbers of foot soldiers. Each time war revived, the poor were drummed back into service, becoming what one scholar has called a reserve army of the unemployed. The life of the early modern soldier was harsh and unpredictable. Disbanded troops often pillaged on their way home. In the popular literature of the day, soldiers turned thieves were the subjects of a number of racy accounts. John Audeley's The Fraternity of Vagabonds, 1561, and others of its kind, depicted the wandering poor as a vast network of predatory gangs. Ex-soldiers filled empty slots in the gangs as upright men or bandit leaders. Connie catchers literally bagged their booty. These consummate robbers had as one tool of their trade the hook, which was jammed through open windows in order to steal valuable goods. In proposing to ship our idle soldiers overseas, Hakluyt aimed to turn con men into actual Connie catchers, shooting rabbits to give hearty substance to the American colonists' daily stew. In other words, sending veteran soldiers and convicts to America would reduce crime and poverty in one masterstroke. Whatever else their lives entailed, vagrants, children of beggars, and ex-soldiers who might be transported to the New World and transplanted onto its soil were thought to be fertilizing wasteland with their labor. Their value was calculated not in humane or even human terms, but as a disembodied commercial force. If that proposition seems cold and calculating, it was. In death, they were, to use the operative modern phrase, collateral damage. They had more value to the realm as dead colonists than as idle waste in England. In his grand scheme, Hakluyt imagined disciplined children of English beggars who survived in the colonies as nothing more than a future pool of soldiers and sailors. Planting unwanted people in American soil meant fewer temptations to take up lives of crime. Some might actually thrive in the open, vacant land of America, because surely they had no chance at all in the overpopulated labor market back home. Still, one cannot resist the conclusion that the children of the poor were regarded as recycled waste. Their destiny, once these same folk were bred up as soldiers and sailors, was to fill out a colonial reserve army of waste men, to be sent to die in England's wars. Brutal exploitation was the modus operandi of the English projectors who conceived an American colonial system at the end of the 16th century, before there were colonies. When Jamestown, the English outpost along the Chesapeake Bay, was finally founded in 1607, the hardships its settlers experienced proved the general flaw in Hakluyt's blueprint for creating real-life colonies. Defenders of the Virginia Company of London published tracts, sermons, and first-hand accounts, all trying to explain away the many bizarre occurrences that haunted Jamestown. Social mores were non-existent. Men defecated in public areas within the small garrison. People sat around and starved. Harsh laws were imposed. Stealing vegetables and blasphemy were punishable by death. Laborers and their children were virtual commodities, effectively slaves. One man murdered his wife and then ate her. After the miscarriage of Sir Walter Raleigh's Roanoke, Jamestown was christened England's first infant child. Biding the English patience with Jamestown, the poet John Donne sermonized in 1622, "Great creatures lie long in the womb." Jamestown's was a slow, painful birth, attended by scant confidence in its future. That year, a lopsided Indian attack nearly wiped out the entire population. The pervasive traumas throughout Jamestown's early years are legend. Before 1625, colonists dropped like flies, 80% of the first 6,000 dying off. Several different military commanders imposed regimes of forced labor that turned the fledgling settlement into a prison camp. Men drawn to Jamestown dreamt of finding gold, which did little to inspire hard work. Not even starvation awoke them from the dream. A new group arrived in 1611 and described how their predecessors wallowed in sluggish idleness and bestial sloth. Yet they fared little better. There were few lusty men in Virginia, to repeat Hakluyt's colorful term. It remained difficult to find recruits who would go out and fell trees, build houses, improve the land, fish, and hunt wild game. The men of early Jamestown were predisposed to play cards, to trade with vile sailors, and to rape Indian women. A glassblower was sent to make colored beads, trinkets to sell to the Indians. This was Hakluyt's idea. But where were the husbandmen needed to raise food? Impracticality, bad decisions, and failed recruitment strategies left the colony with too few plowmen and husbandmen to tend the fields and feed the cattle that were being shipped from England. Jamestown lost sight of the English creed expressed in Thomas More's Utopia, 1516, that every productive society prized its tillers of the earth. More wrote that in failing to promote husbandry, no commonwealth could hold out a year. John Rolfe, husband of Pocahontas, took these words to heart. In 1609, he introduced the strain of tobacco from Bermuda that Virginia's settlers succeeded with, and tobacco quickly became the new gold, the ticket to wealth. Its discovery led to a boom economy, bringing high prices for the filthy weed. Tobacco was at once both a boon and bane. Though it saved the colony from ruin, it stunted the economy and generated a skewed class system. The governing council jealously guarded what soon became the colony's most precious resource, laborers. The only one of Hakluyt's lessons to be carefully heeded was the one they applied with vengeance, exploiting a vulnerable, dependent workforce. The governor and members of his governing council pleaded with the Virginia Company to send over more indentured servants and laborers, who, like slaves, were sold to the highest bidder. Indentured servants were hoarded, overworked, and their terms unfairly extended. Land was distributed unequally, too, which increased the class divide. Those who settled before 1616, who had paid their own passage, were given 100 acres. After that date, new arrivals who paid their own way received only 50 acres. More important, from 1618, those who brought over an indentured servant received an additional 50 acres. The headright system, as it was known, allotted land by counting heads. More bodies in a planter's stable meant more land. Significantly, if a servant died on the voyage over, the owner of the indenture still secured all of his promised acreage. It paid to import laborers, dead or alive. Contracts of indenture were longer than servant contracts in England, 4 to 9 years versus 1 to 2 years. According to a 1662 Virginia law, children remained servants until the age of 24. Indentures were unlike wage contracts. Servants were classified as chattels, as movable goods and property. Contracts could be sold, and servants were bound to move where and when their masters moved. Like furniture or livestock, they could be transferred to one's heirs. The leading planters in Jamestown had no illusion that they were creating a classless society. From 1616 to 1623, a good many orphans from London were shipped to Virginia. Most indentured servants who followed in their train were adolescent boys. As a small, privileged group of planters acquired land, laborers, and wealth, those outside the inner circle were hard-pressed to escape their lower status. Those who did become poor tenants found that little had changed in their condition. They were often forced to do the same work they had done as servants. A sizable number did not survive their years of service. Or, as John Smith lamented in his 1624 General History of Virginia, "This dear-bought land with so much blood and cost hath only made some few rich and all the rest losers." Among the more insidious practices in the colony, wives and children were held accountable for their husbands' or fathers' indentured period of labor. After the natives attacked in 1622, a colonist named Jane Dickinson was held by them in captivity for 10 months. When she returned to Jamestown, she was told that she owed 150 pounds of tobacco to her husband's former master. Unable to pay, she would be forced to work off her dead husband's unmet obligations. She appealed to the governor, writing that her treatment was identical to the slavery she experienced among the cruel savages. Had English civilization been sacrificed in this colonial wasteland? That was Dickinson's unspoken message. Nor was her treatment unusual. John Smith acknowledged in his General History that fatherless children were left in little better condition than slaves, for if their parents die in debt, their children are made bondmen until the debt be discharged. The leaders of Jamestown had borrowed directly from the Roman model of slavery. Abandoned children and debtors were made slaves. When indentured adults sold their anticipated labor in return for passage to America, they instantly became debtors, which made their orphaned children a collateral asset. It was a world not unlike that one Shakespeare depicted in The Merchant of Venice, when Shylock demanded his pound of flesh. Virginia planters felt entitled to their flesh and blood in the forms of the innocent spouses and offspring of dead servants. If civilization was to be firmly planted, Jamestown would have to be given the look of a normal English village, along with efforts to promote good habits among the people. The colony needed to shed its image as a penal colony and to plant firmer roots. It needed more than tobacco. It needed herds of cattle, fields of crops, and improved relations between masters and servants. Most of all, it needed many more manageable women. In 1620, the Virginia Company sent to the colony 57 young, handsome, and honestly educated maids. Over the next 3 years, 157 more women made the crossing. They were thought of as emissaries of a new moral order. Company records hint at something else as well. The greatest hindrances to noble work rested on want of comforts. Men deserved to live contentedly. The transportation of female cargo would tie and root the planters' minds to Virginia by the bonds of wives and children. Sexual satisfaction and heirs to provide for would make slothful men into more productive colonists. All that was required of the women was that they marry. Their prospective husbands were expected to buy them, that is, to defray the cost of passage and provisions. Each woman was valued at 150 pounds of tobacco, which was the same price exacted from Jane Dickinson when she eventually purchased her freedom. Not surprisingly, then, with their value calculated in tobacco, women in Virginia were treated as fertile commodities. They came with testimonials to their moral character, impressing on industrious planters that they were not being sold a bad bill of goods. One particular planter wrote that an earlier shipment of females was corrupt, and he expected a new crop that was guaranteed healthy and favorably disposed for breeding. Accompanying the female cargo were some 200 head of cattle, a reminder that the Virginia husbandman needed both species of breeding stock to recover his English roots. Despite everything, Jamestown never became a stable agrarian community. The Virginia plantation remained strangely barren during the first half of the 17th century. First, the anticipated harvest of the region's natural resources did not occur, nor did the various ranks and stations, balancing skilled laborers and manual workers, form according to plan. As late as 1663, Governor William Berkeley was still advocating for the goods Hakluyt had proposed, flax and hemp, timber and tar for ships, and exotics such as silk and olive oil. The vicious, ruinous plant of tobacco, as Berkeley condemned it, left Virginia without a diversified economy. At the heart of the Jamestown system was the indentured contract that made laborers disposable property. In so harsh an environment, survival was difficult, and the unappreciated waste people were literally worked to death. Young men and boys who came without families were the most vulnerable and most exploited of all. Unable to plant roots, many failed to produce heirs and secure the cherished English ideal of attachment to the land. Class divisions were firmly entrenched. The ever-widening gap in land ownership elevated large planters into a small, privileged faction. At the same time, the labor system reduced servants to debt slaves, and, living so far from home, they had little recourse to demand better treatment. Isolation, then, increased the potential for abuse. The only liberty for colonial servants came with their feet, by running away. Jamestown's founders reproduced no English villages. Instead, they fashioned a ruthless class order.